edition of Turn Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, stand-up comedian, an actor, a musician, but someone that produced something that has affected my life so profoundly that I'm going to say it's the best movie I've seen this year. Would you call it a comedy special a movie? Anyway, we'll talk about all this in one second. Whitmer Thomas is on the show today, and you may have seen him on the Walking Dead, on Glow, on all these sorts of, like, you know, he's been in a bunch of things over the years, but if you have not seen his The Golden One special, I implore you, just hit pause on this. If you have HBO or access to HBO or a friend with HBO that's giving you their account during this time or whatever, however you have to see this thing, see it. It is, I did not know what to expect when I saw it. My brother just recommended it to me. I saw it and oh, wow. I can't believe I'm rambling this much in the introduction. I normally ramble as we get into the show a little bit, but I can't say enough about this Golden One special. It is really that good. Anyway, more on that in one second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. There's also a Facebook page and an Instagram page. All of those are run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire and comedy special recommender extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Tristan, I love you so much, buddy. And I really appreciate all the work you do. Thank you very much. If you want to get in touch with me, you can head over to the Instagram and Twitter pages at Left for Damien. I'm really trying not to check them as often these days because of everything that's going on, but I do check them. So please send me a message there and I will try and I'm going to try and make a point of communicating better over those things too, because I know we all need to communicate more now, you know, this kind of reaching out and, you know, getting someone to answer back is extremely important right now, and I recognize that. So I'm going to try and do better on that front. And if you would like to support the podcast, the best way of supporting this podcast is by telling everyone you know that you love this thing and that we're doing it out here, and by subscribing to it and rating it if you can on your platform of choice. But yeah, just listen now, you know, just don't worry about anything else. If you have some extra money and you want to, we do a Patreon where we do footnotes and all sorts of other fun stuff over there. So you can check out turnoutapunk.com/Patreon. And if you have some extra money, because right now I know things are a little weird, definitely a little weird. So I can completely understand. Speaking of support, though, this show would not be possible without the kind, loving support of Vans. Vans came aboard a few years ago and said, do what you do. And they've recently come aboard again. So I really appreciate them doing that. And that's it. I think, yeah, that's it for that side of the show. You know, I hope everyone's doing okay right now. It's a weird situation. It's only getting a little bit weirder. But, you know, we're here. We're here. We're appreciating what we have. We're looking around and realizing that we're going to get through this. And, yeah, when I say we, I mean me and my family, because we are now one unit. We live together all the time. And, you know, I'm sure you can relate to that. So anyway, let's go to something that we also can all relate to, which is a need for an escape once in a while. And today we are going to be talking to Whitmer Thomas. Now, if you are not familiar with Whit, I've got to be honest with you. I'd seen him in things, but I was not familiar with him until I saw this special. And once I saw this special, I became a bit obsessed. You will hear this on the show. I'm a bit of a fan now. This comedy special, see, I lost my mom, as many of you know, because there's episodes about it. I talk about it pretty openly on this thing a few years ago. And to be honest with you, ever since then, you know, there's definitely been things I've watched and things I've enjoyed, but it was different, you know, it was really different, especially something that dealt with anything kind of serious, and especially something that dealt with the loss of a parent. You know, it just wasn't my kind of entertainment. And, you know, I come to entertainment for a bit of an escape sometimes, like all of us do. And yeah, I wasn't able to escape that way. And so my brother recommended seeing this comedy special. I don't even think he hit me to what was going on in it too much. He just was like, you got to check this out. This guy's punk. We should get him on the show. You're really going to love this thing. And so, you know, begrudgingly, I threw it on one night with Lauren. And as soon as we kind of realized what it was going to be about, she's like, are you sure you're okay to watch this? And I was even by that point like, no, I think I need to watch this. And I watched the whole thing and, you know, I laughed a lot, definitely laughed a lot. It's a comedy special. I shed some tears. You know, I really did shed some tears watching this thing. And it's not just for people that have lost a family member. Like, it's just for, I don't know, just anyone that kind of deals with expectations and deals with, you know, and those are self-imposed expectations too, obviously, or anyone that deals with loss, or anyone that's dealing with a disconnect with the people they grew up with. Everyone should see this thing. I really cannot recommend this enough. So I'm not going to yammer on anymore. We go into a lot more details about all this stuff in the episode with Wit. So yeah, that's it. I'm just going to let you sit back, relax, and enjoy Whitmer Thomas on Turned Out a Punk. Wit, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, pal.
Well, I'm going to break down the fourth wall, and I had a recording hiccup 2 seconds ago, and so we're doing this again, and I'm going to subject you to this awkward introduction one more time. I promise just the last time.
But, dude, I'll take it. I love it. I love hearing it.
Okay, well, that's good, because now you've heard it 3 times. But honestly, when my brother came to me and was like, you got to check out this comedy special, I was resistant because, you know, like I don't always identify with stand-up specials. I find stand-up live is so different. But your thing is, the special you made, I don't know, it's so much more than a special. It's legitimately the best thing I've seen, without hyperbole, film, TV show in years. And it hit me in a really profound way. And hearing you talk about punk on that, it just made perfect sense to invite you on the show. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, pal. And it's very cool that you reached out, and we have like a connection that you don't even know exists, which is, I used to be in a sketch group called Power Violence, which I'm aware of the genre Power Violence, and I was before, and we just thought, oh, it'd be funny to call a comedy group Power Violence. And then what ended up happening is we alienated a lot of true fans of the Power Violence music, and they hated us. But yeah, we used to be in a sketch group, and we would play Son the Father by – that's the name of that song,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That. Yeah, by Y'all, and because it has this flute intro, or it's – that's flute, right?
It's our drummer's mom playing it on the record.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Yeah, so that has that long flute intro. So we would turn out all the lights in the theater, and it'd be pitch black dark. And that intro would be playing, and then we'd be screaming and freaking everybody out. And then right when the song would kick, the strobe lights would come on, and we would throw toilet paper at the crowd. And it was as soon as like I figured out that, yeah, you wanted to do this, I was like, holy hell, I got to do it.
That, I got to see video of this. This is like – that might be one of the greatest tributes our band has ever received, I think.
Yeah, man, it was I wish that there was video. I'm sure somewhere there is video of this. We did it all over the place. We did it all over the country.
That's amazing.
We owe you probably like $22.
Well, you know, I owe you for the laughs and the tears on the comedy special. So we'll call it even, you know.
Well, thank you, dude.
I got to though start this thing off the way they all start off, which is, wait, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yes, I do. My brother playing Brohim by Pennywise.
Yes!
And I don't know, probably right when that record came out, which was mid-90s, I guess.
Yeah.
In the back of my mom's car, listening to that. And my mom loved it. She loved that chant, and she loved the bass line. And it was like life-changing. It was a life-changing moment. I remember, it's the perfect punk song for like I was like a kid. I was like six, seven years old. That chant, you know, I just loved that. And then my mom was like, oh, you like that? You like that? You know, she was a musician. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, I love that. And she was like, oh my God, maybe we have a bass player in the family. Because that bass line. She always wanted me to be a bass player. So she got me a bass guitar and taught me how to play that song. She figured it out and then taught me that bass line. And it was a game changer.
Oh, that's amazing. No, that is definitely – you know, from the epiphat genre, I think that's like the anthem that emerged.
Yeah. I mean, could you imagine that got a truly tragic circumstances, that song.
Yeah.
It's got to feel good to come out with something like that.
Well, there's also, because they did release it twice, right? Like, they released it the first time in 91, and I think the time you would have been hearing it was when they did Brohim 98, which was in tribute to the bass player who had passed away.
Yeah, and that's the one that I prefer.
Mm-hmm, me too.
Is, the guy hops on stage and sings the second or third verse, or he's like, Jason, my brother, this was my, he, like, his voice cracks, and
yeah.
I just think it's incredible.
It's amazing, too, when you listen to that, because, like, obviously that band and that genre gets a lot of dismissed outright mm-hmm. by a lot of punk fans, like probably the same people that were offended that you called your Night Power Violence
right.
or your True Power Violence. But like at the same time, like that is like one of the purest emotions I've heard on any recorded song ever. When his voice breaks, when he says that, like it still sends shivers up my spine.
Yeah. I have full body chills right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Same like goosebumps. It's like, it's definitely like that. And especially as a young person to kind of hear that when everything else you kind of hear is just so prefabricated, it's just that cuts through.
Yeah, man. So cool. So cool.
So I noticed also your mom's music, like, you know, it's obviously not punk, but at the same time, it is kind of got a new wave kind of informed vibe to it. Like, did you grow up around that kind of stuff in the house?
Yeah, dude, my mom. So like when my mom was in her 20s, she was all about getting out of the South, you know, mm-hmm. from Alabama. She ran away to L.A. and Aspen and New York and lived in Jamaica for a long time with her twin sister. And they wanted to distance themselves from that. So and that was around the time of like the synthesizer and mm-hmm. the drum machine. So a lot of their early recordings are very new wave, like synth heavy songs. And in the later 80s, mid to late 80s, they moved back to Alabama and their songs kind of went kind of back to being more traditionally kind of country pop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you have any of the recordings from the new wave stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
There's one on YouTube called He's Hot.
Oh, I definitely – I know He's Hot. He's Hot has become a very favorite YouTube view of mine since then because it is super catchy.
Yeah, dude. It's incredible.
It's incredible.
And I had no idea. Like I found that in the comedy special that you can see that me and my aunt are looking through old master tape recordings.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the first time I had ever seen any of that stuff. I thought it was ruined by Hurricane Katrina. That's what my mom told me, at least. But my aunt had saved some of them. And so when I got back to LA, I digitized. I saw if like – you know, I asked somebody if they could digitize them and see if they were worth – if they were salvageable. And they were like, yeah, dude, this is 2-inch tape. Like these things are indestructible. So I have all of them. I have all of her songs all the way back to 1975.
Wow, that's amazing. So she was – what was her stuff early on like back in 75?
It's her just playing acoustic guitar and with her sister and kind of just like kind of folk music. Mm-hmm. Then they go to Jamaica and they become like super into reggae. And in a very embarrassing to listen to kind of way, sometimes doing like a fake Jamaican accent.
They're foreshadowing, California ska punk.
Totally. And dude, oh my God, when I got into ska, it was like my mom loved to drive around listening to Less Than Jake and stuff. She really, and there's like a couple really kind of more reggae focused NOFX songs. My mom was like, this is it. This is so good. No, I was just going to say, but yeah. So like something that's kind of funny and so I found these demos, right?
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully everybody, I'm going to put out all of these songs, like the ones that I think she would have liked people to hear at least in the next couple months. But like there's one demo called Southern Girl. And I remember the song Southern Girl. I remember watching her band play it as a kid. And it's talking about how she's a Southern girl. And she loves being from the South. No matter where she goes, she's always going to be a Southern girl. But then I found a demo, right, from the late 70s called Southern Girl. And it's the same melody, same mostly everything, except it's talking about getting out of the South and not wanting to be like how the South hangs over her, and she doesn't want to be represented by the South because she's cool and she's like she wants to be a big city girl. And it's kind of funny, like it's kind of sad in a way. It's like the second version is her kind of accepting it and sort of going, giving up, and you know, in a way. Or you could also say she's accepting it and owning it, you know, but just depends.
What an amazing thing to kind of come into of all that kind of stuff, like to just be, have that kind of window into her growing up.
Oh dude, it's crazy. It's like hours and hours of, you know, my mom is like a 20-year-old, yeah, just like goofing off in Aspen with her sister and like recording it, you know, so it's cool. I'm really lucky that I was able to get that stuff.
Have you ever thought about putting anything out on vinyl, or did they actually ever put out anything on vinyl back then?
No, they didn't put anything out. I'm like, they were really mismanaged and there was a lot of like tragedy around them, and you know, my both with drugs and death and all this kind of stuff. And so by the time they were in their mid-20s, it was kind of a wash. Mm-hmm. And my mom's husband went to prison for drug smuggling, and she sort of didn't know what to do. She had had one brother of mine who died, and then my brother who, and then, you know, is still around and I'm very close with. And then my aunt sort of wanted to get away from that whole scene, and she moved back to Alabama. So their like professional dreams at that point were put on hold.
So you got to do a He's Hot 7-inch for Record Store Day or something.
Dude, I've got a whole, I want to do like these great, this like new presentation of demos and music videos and stuff. Like, I'm going to figure out some cool stuff.
That's awesome. Well, I guess going back to that faithful Pennywise car ride, had your brother been into punk rock stuff before that, or was that his first kind of discovery too?
Yeah, you know, my brother was like, he's a surfer, skater guy, and he's a really good guitarist, so he loved like the blues, and I think got into skateboarding, and then through skating got into, you know, Screeching Weasel and Pennywise and Blink-182 and those kinds of bands. But and that's like really where he found himself, I think. Mm-hmm. And he was in a cover band called Toxic Toothpaste. And I would go see them play and go into the mosh pit, and nobody would push me because I was a tiny child. But yeah, it was cool.
What kind of covers would they do?
They did Damn It by Blink. They did My Right by Screeching Weasel. And then they did Bro Him. And I'm sure they did some other ones. I think they did M&M's by Blink-182 as well.
I think you just described my perfect set list. Like, really, that, like, honestly, that, like, those are, like, especially, I love that song by Screeching Weasel is a rager.
Yeah, man. It's so good. And anybody can play it. It takes, like, 1 minute to learn how to play that song.
It's a good one to cover. Yeah. Where were you guys hearing music at this time? Was it mainly through, like, MTV, or was there cool radio, or?
No, man. There was nothing. It was, like, in Alabama, there's, I mean, if I saw Ruby Soho on MTV one time and like just like walked into my, like, you know, TV room, and it was on TV and my brother was watching it on like 120, what was it called?
120 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit. And, you know, and then other than that, there's nothing on the radio. It was go to a CD shop like an hour away, and whatever album cover looked kind of punk, you just buy it, you know. So that's what I would do.
Were there any bands that were kind of coming through town around then?
No, not really, man. It was like, I guess when I got a little bit older, when I hit like 13, we started going to Pensacola. My brother would let me go with him, which was an hour away from where I grew up. And my first show was the Suicide Machines and Catch 22.
The ska punk Super Bill.
Yeah. And that was really cool. And I saw Strike Anywhere a bunch of times. They would always come through. And Against Me lived not too far away, so they would come through. So I saw Against Me when their drummer didn't even have a drum set. He was like playing on a bunch of shit, just like bullshit. So and then there was a local band called This Bike Is a Pipe Bomb.
Oh, they're from Alabama?
Yeah, they're from Florida, but
from Florida, right
on the line of Florida and Alabama. So, So that was like a very special time, like the beginning of a scene, it felt like, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I've had a bunch of people on from Florida over the years, but more recently, and it's amazing how, because that was so skipped over by touring bands for so long, how it forced kind of like a real unique scene to develop. And when it finally exploded, like the time you're talking about, like you had bands like Against Me, you had Dashboard Confessional, you had Assuck, you had like, it was just so much different stuff coming out of the state.
Yeah, man, it was my brother went to see, actually he was like, we're going to see Further Seems Forever, and I wasn't allowed to go, but he went, and he was like, it sucked, Chris Carrabba quit. It was like the week that he quit the band for Dashboard or something like that. And you're like, why'd he quit? And my brother's like, some fucking band called Dashboard. Dashboard Confessional. I was like, no. But yeah, dude. And the scene, eventually, you know, I started playing in bands, and it was crazy. We would be on the bill with like a power violence band, a folk punk band, just a traditional ska band, you know? Mm-hmm. There was – because there wasn't enough bands for there to be like little niche scenes.
Yeah. No, it's funny because like you talk to someone who grew up in New York, you know, or someone who grew up in Los Angeles, and there's like so much more of that. Like, you know, you could be in like, oh, I'm into this one specific subgenre only, but everyone else, it's like, no, I was just into general alternative music. We had to all pool our resources to make a scene.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's really lucky, I think, that, you know.
Were there, like you mentioned playing in bands. When did you start playing in a band?
I started playing in a band that would actually go out of town and play shows when I was in ninth grade. So I was 14.
And what was the first band called?
Oh, the first like real band that would actually go out of town was called Say Your Last. And we were very much like an emo band that went on to like evolve through all of the genres of emo and screamo and hardcore and grindcore and metalcore and whatever it would be, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So where were you kind of getting into stuff as this, you know, these transitions are taking on? Is by that point, I guess, downloading was kind of starting and.
Yeah. You know, sadly, Alabama was still pretty behind. No, it was like my brother would get me a CD a lot of times. He would buy me a CD. It would be a lot of local bands going, buying their stuff. And I didn't really download. I downloaded a lot of like – I feel like all the stuff I would download off of Kazaa or whatever would be like Me First in the Gimme Gimme. Shit like that. But then it was still going to East Hill Records in Pensacola and hoping that they had like fucking Cries from the Past or Cries of the Past by Under Oath. And then being like, oh man, I'm going to have to go to the Christian record store. A lot of would buy a lot of that genre at the Christian bookstore.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm fascinated by that. Like, I'd love to see a documentary about Tooth and Nail Records, like this parallel kind of scene that was happening at the same time that did overlap in a lot of ways, especially in Florida.
Yeah. And everybody was, it was like all a lie. I remember the only way, we were never a Christian band. We were like, no, fuck that. But like, if you wanted to play a show, like a good show, it was always at a church.
Yeah.
And like, you just would have to pray ahead of time. It was so uncomfortable.
You'd have to go there and pray with them before they let you play.
Yeah, yeah. So
it's like a pray-to-play show?
Yeah, pray-to-play. Dude, totally. That would be the name of the movie, pray-to-play.
Pray-to-play. That's, yeah. We've come up with a couple different movie ideas already in this conversation, I think.
Yeah, we got to stick together.
We got to stick together, yeah. We're going places, kid. But, like, yeah, it's funny how, you know, because Toronto is different, but like talking to people that grew up, you know, once again, especially in the part that you're of the country, U.S. country, I mean, that you're growing up in. I'm in Canada, by the way. I should throw that out there so I don't sound weird. But like, you know, it felt like that, you know, is such a part of just like the culture in general that it seeped into like even alternative culture. And maybe it looked like, you know, and I don't know, this was probably felt this way as a secular person looking from a distance, but it always felt like it was almost like a recruiting thing.
Yeah, it kind of was. It's still confusing to me, that era, because so many of those bands, I feel like, denounced it. They like nowadays they go, oh, it was a lie, or like, oh, we don't, we're not actually Christian anymore. And it's like, cool, so you went and got like a 6-album record deal and toured around and I'm sure had sex with very questionably aged women at Cornerstone Festival or whatever.
Yeah.
And now you're like, oh, guess what? We're actually not a Christian band. So it's almost like I would prefer they're all like preachers now or something like that. But
yeah, it was whatever. It was all real. Like, it wasn't a pose at all.
Like, yeah.
I find it either way kind of disturbing. I think, like, you know, knowing that it was a bit of an act, you're right, like, it's definitely much more cynical and slightly evil, especially the underage stuff at potentially Cornerstone. But but at the same time, I think it's also, like, imagine they had, like, militarized an entire generation of Hot Topic kids into, like, religious voters now.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what's so funny, man. It's like so many of those scene kids are now like Trumpy kind of like it's weird. You'd think like these kids who like used to straighten their hair and wear girl jeans would be more like on the progressive cool side. But yeah. It's funny, like going back home, a lot of those kids that I used to play shows with in bands are now like super redneck Trump guys. It's weird how that worked out.
It's almost like well, it's a groupthink that people get caught up in punk rock in general, you know, in hardcore in general. And it's just, which way do you break?
Yeah, totally. It's like, did you go the tough guy route?
Yeah.
Or did you go the silly idiot route?
Yeah. Or did you go like the person who listened to too much Propaganda route? Or did you go the person that listened to too much Misfits route? Or like, you know, I much prefer going, listen to too much Propaganda is where I'm at. So
same, me too, dude. In eighth grade, I did a report. They were supposed to like do a report on a song or something. And so I brought in, I can't remember the name of the Propaganda song. But it was a Propaganda song, very political. It was like,
Nation States.
Nation States.
That's yeah.
And I remember thinking, okay, I'll just play this song and then I'll describe what it's about. And then I played it and then I was like, this song is about how messed up. Dang it. I just kind of realized like I actually had no idea what it was about.
I think it only really hit me in the last few years what that song's about. And like, you know, when you break down all the lyrics, like they're such a great band, you know, like so many people talk about Rage Against the Machine, but like here's a band that's like sampling Noam Chomsky things and like telling you to read Howard Zinn books. It was just like, what a great band for like a young person to stumble upon.
I know, man. They're cool. And you get the Weaker Thans.
And you get the Weaker Thans later on, so you can grow older with them, too.
All right.
Where did you go from there, like, as far as, like, playing local shows? Like, you said you toured a little bit. How far did you tour out?
We would just tour the Southeast. So our route would be, you know, Birmingham, Atlanta, Nashville, Memphis, Charlotte, North Carolina, Greensboro, somewhere in South Carolina, Tallahassee, Jacksonville.
And you mentioned like the band changed styles, but did you ever put out any releases?
What was that?
You mentioned the band changed styles at different times, but did you ever put out any releases?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we did. We put out an EP called Love Has Failed to Show, which is embarrassing. But
I think it's true. It rings true, you know?
Right. Yeah. We put out an EP and then we recorded a more professional couple of songs in a studio where I had really learned how to scream at that point. Everybody was really impressed with how I had actually learned how to scream the right way and stuff. It was a good moment for me. And then this dude who was running this label out of his mom's basement said, I'd love to work with you guys. And by then we were a little bit older and, I think we were just kind of like, I don't know if we want to do this for anymore, like forever, you know, like we kind of decided, you know, it's funny. I was just talking about this with Clay, who's my directing partner. He co-directed my special with me, but grew up together and we were both in that band. And our buddy who was the drummer was like a few years older than us. He was like well out of high school. And, all the other guys were like 16, 17, and we were kind of just like, do you guys not want to do this anymore? And he was trying to get us to go meet him at band practice. And we were like, yeah, we don't want to do this. And so we all quit the band and we're like, sorry, dude, we're not coming. We're not going to be the band anymore. And then he was like, what? And then we were just talking about it recently. Like, did we ruin his life? Like, because now me and you are out in LA and like we're still making stuff together, but what is he up, you know what I mean? Like, that was his thing. He was a grown up, he was an adult at that point.
But he had to know when he put a bunch of kids in his band that one day they might grow up and leave the nest.
Yeah, that's true.
You'd hope.
That's true.
But that's still well, that's another thing I want to talk to you about. In the special, the music's fantastic, like incredible songs there. What are the influences into those songs? Like, there's so many different styles there. Did you go in with different influences? Like, did the joke come before the song or did the song come before the joke? Like, how did that process work?
Yeah, those songs, a lot of them I had written sincerely, like, and I had recorded them in a less kind of synthesizer-y way, you know, just with a guitar and a bass and some drums. And then the lyrics, you know, like, weren't super funny. And I listened back and I was singing more with like my natural singing voice on those demos. And I just felt like so embarrassed by it. And then my friend asked me to do a show where he was like, but don't do stand up. Like, your section of the show, you're not allowed to do stand up. You have to think of something else. And so I was like, oh, maybe I'll like think of a song. He goes, oh no, it's supposed to be an ad. Your section of the show needs to be a fake advertisement for something. I was like, oh, okay. So the fake advertisement was to go out on a date with me, but it's a warning. And so then I changed one of the songs to be Partied to Death, which is the song about my mom drinking herself to death. And the warning is going like, if you hang out with me, this might come up, you know what I mean? So just be ready. And then I pretty quickly, that was a few years ago, kind of was like, oh, because people took out their phones. They started filming me do that. And that never happened to me before. And I was like, oh shit, maybe I should start doing musical comedy more, like more seriously. So I kind of revisited a lot of my songs and changed a lot of the lyrics, you know, like, and yeah, so it was all music first. And then the joke came afterwards.
It's funny. I just had Mike Watt on the podcast recently, and he talked about how he calls it the movement, but just punk broadly termed, but like how so much of it at the beginning was about humor. And like, it was obviously very serious and like addressing serious real things, but there was always like a humorous side to it. And you're like, you look at the Dead Kennedys and you look at even Black Flag and these bands, like there is that kind of sense of humor. And the period of punk that, you know, both you and I kind of came up in, you know, it was either super goofy stuff, like very silly, or it was like uber serious, like no humor at all. And yeah. So I don't like, I find the songs in the show like so punk in like that Mike Watt kind of way where it's like you're dressing deadly serious things, like even insecurities, like sexual insecurities and things like that. But there's like a humor to it that's not like ever silly, but like, I don't know, it's punk.
Oh, well, that's cool. Thanks, man. I mean, yeah, and all of them are fundamentally kind of punk songs, like Dumb in Love, like the original, it's just a song that I sing about wishing that I was just kind of stupid and how much better that would be right now, and politically at least. And that song originally was just a full pop punk song. It was just a really upbeat pop punk song. And then when we recorded it for my album, we just changed it and slowed it down. But yeah, I think that there's something so authentic about and vulnerable about a lot of the punk music that I really love, and how a lot of the times these singers they don't have the vocabulary to articulate what they're trying to say in a super metaphorical or poetic way. And that bluntness, right? Removing the metaphor is so comedic, but also so emotional and vulnerable. And I feel like that's what I aim to do as a musician.
Like, when the band wound down and you both moved out to LA, was the original plan like to do what you're doing now, or did you want to kind of start music out there, or like what was the vision going out west?
No, I wanted to be an actor. I had moved. I had met some guy in Florida who was like, who worked at a special effects company in L.A. He was like, "Come out to L.A. I'll give you a job as a PA." And then I moved out to L.A. right when I turned 18, and he never answered my phone call. And then I got a job working at the skate shop and was going to acting classes, and pretty quickly kind of realized like I don't belong in this like acting person world. And and Clay then moved out, and then another guy from Alabama moved out, and then we met another guy who played drums. So we started playing in this punk band around town called Tooks, T-O-O-K-S, which is a terrible band name and nobody ever said it right. But oh, and I guess it's also a hat in Canada as a toque or
a toque. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's spelled just like that. But so we would play around, and we just had like a really hard time getting adjusted. We were so stupid. We talked way too much in between songs, and we're just like, we didn't know how to be cool. We wanted really badly to be accepted by like the smell, the kids at the smell. Yes. And stuff.
Yeah.
And like the new garage rock wave, like it was kind of during the break of like Ty Segall and all those guys. And we just were like, we got to figure out how to exist amongst these people, you know? And then what really happened was my mom died. And when she died, she left me like $5,000. And I started doing – I rented that theater. And so me and the guys would just play little dumb videos, and sometimes we'd play music. And eventually we just stopped playing music and just started only doing comedy, and found that we kind of – it made more sense for us to be doing that than to be trying to get in at the smell.
It's such a – like that smell scene, like even going out there when we first went out there, like I guess which would have been a couple of years earlier, it was so impenetrably cool. and also they had banned hardcore bands for a long time. Like they would not book hardcore bands. And so there was like a real like divide. Once again, probably with the people that were offended that you called the troupe Power Violence. But there was like,
right,
they were all like, oh, fuck that place. They don't like hardcore. They don't like punk. And it was like a separate scene for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. The hardcore scene, dude, going out to LA, I don't think I've still to this day been to a hardcore show that wasn't in a garage or inside of a house. Yes. I don't know where they do hardcore shows in LA.
I guess at that point it was the Echo, like the small room at the Echo would have stuff. First time we went out there, we were playing like where it was still like where you could have a warehouse party. Like obviously gentrification has ruined punk rock venues forever. Everywhere. It's hard.
It's weird. Yeah. That was what we would do most of the time too, is play at these really cool warehouse shows. And we would often go down to Orange County. We found like Orange County was like more similar to where we were from, and we would be playing like noise shows, but our band was like kind of just like a garage blues punk band.
Did you guys record?
Yeah, we recorded a bunch actually. We have a ton of recordings. Like I'm sure if you like looked it up on SoundCloud, there'd probably be recordings of our band somewhere.
The Tooks. I'm definitely going to, that's going to be my first thing I do when I hang up with the phone off with you. Check out that, because yeah, like it's, you know, you mentioned that garage rock revival kind of thing that I guess started in San Francisco, but it was also in LA, like Michael Cronin and stuff was in LA, and it just,
yeah,
it was just like so much great stuff happening. At that time, like it was like just, you know, a lot of cool bands like the OCs, like Ty, like just a lot of great stuff.
Yeah. And what's so funny is like when I had been doing comedy for a few years, I started seeing those guys popping up at just like watching comedy shows. And I was like, oh, wow. OK, that's funny here. This, you know, and now I know a lot of those guys, mm-hmm. guys now a little bit. And it's just so funny, how it kind of flipped around, you know.
Well, now's the time to get the band back together. You're in now. You're in. Right. Now you got all the slots you could handle for the show.
Yeah, dude.
Growing up, what kind of comedy stuff were you into?
The first thing that ever made me like die laughing that was professional, like, comedy that wasn't like a Jim Carrey movie or Austin Powers or something, mm-hmm. was Eddie Murphy in Delirious doing a bit about the ice cream man coming to town. Yeah. Like, that bit just made me – I had never seen stand-up comedy where it was like that funny before. And a lot of the other stuff hasn't aged well at all, but that one joke is timeless. And then I liked like Mitch Hedberg, and through him found out about Zach Galifianakis and Maria Bamford and those people. And yeah, but the gateway I think was probably Ace Ventura. Like, that was like the beginning of comedy for me.
What about Kids in the Hall? Was that shown at all? I know it was shown on TV in America at different times, but did you see that at all growing up?
Oh, yeah. Kids in the Hall would play right after school on Comedy Central.
Obviously, you're doing something completely different, but that's sort of the sensibility I kind of saw, like the honesty and the kind of vulnerability that they were bringing. And that was growing up, like, here, that was our Saturday Night Live.
Right, yeah. Kids in the Hall was great. No, I loved Kids in the Hall. I sometimes will see Dave Foley walking around. I'm so starstruck.
I think news radio is kind of like an underrated TV show.
Yeah, dude, me too.
I'll go back and watch that. Anytime it's on TV, I can't change the channel.
Oh, it's a good. It holds up. You got Joe Rogan in there too.
I know. Who would have thought that dude would become the political influencer that he is? Like, that dude, that guy.
That guy? Yeah. So funny.
Are you ever going to do bands, you think, again? Seriously? Like, I love the music in the show. Like, would you ever want to do, like, less of a comedy band, but, a band that toured and kind of did that side of things?
I don't know about tour. Touring is tricky for me. I don't mind it. It's just I've never been a person who's ever been able to sell a damn ticket to anything. So, like... I just wonder what it would be like to be able to sell tickets, and if it would change my approach kind of to touring and stuff like that. But it's nice now to play music because I just go with a guitar and sometimes a keyboard, and then the rest of it is like a backing track. But I think for my next record, which will probably be like 50-50 comedy and then comedy music, and then 50% more like sincere music. Mm-hmm. I want to have like a real band, and I want to, really think about the presentation of the music in more of a fun, very much a musician's music kind of way, mm-hmm. A lot of the reason the music now is the way that it sounds is because I would feel uncomfortable like playing to a backing track of like an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
So I wanted it to be like pretty synthetic sounding, so it's okay,
But it's great because it does have that new wave vibe. It's got kind of like a pulp vibe. It's got like it makes it seem like you're saying, like on an acoustic guitar it would sound awkward, but here it sounds so grandiose the way you did it.
Thanks, dude. Thank you. Yeah, I was just trying to think of I don't know how I wanted it to just feel theatrical, mm-hmm. I guess. It just kind of worked out that way.
At some point down the line, would you come back to this thing for a part two?
Totally. Yeah.
Before you go though, I have to ask you one thing, one joke in the special stood out to me. Did you specifically pick Fugazi to troll emo kids?
No, I had tried 700 other bands. I used to say Rites of Spring.
That's what it seemed like. It definitely. Okay.
And people didn't know who that was. And then when I would say Fugazi, it was a dude. I can't remember where I was. I was on tour somewhere out of town. And I sat there saying, like, who actually knows this genre? And like, because a lot of people would say, like, they want me to say Taking Back Sunday or something like that.
Yeah.
But that they didn't invent emo, like, and I don't want to, So it was a whole dialogue. The truth is, it started with emo was invented in the 80s. And then I would just do the bit. But then people would go, well, no, it wasn't. Emo was Taking Back Sunday. I'm like, no. It's existed since way before that. And then I was like, emo was invented in the 80s with Rites of Spring. And then people go, what the – who the fuck is that? But then if I changed it to Fugazi, people would go, oh, I think I've heard of Fugazi, you know? So it hurts every time I have to watch the special and I see me say Fugazi. But I feel like it was a band that is an easier pull for people, so I say Fugazi.
I went into this podcast, you know, loving you and loving what you've done, but that has just increased tenfold by that answer to that question. It was, I don't know, like, are you familiar with the Patton Oswalt first record they did on Sub Pop?
Oh, maybe.
Okay, he's got this one joke in it where he's talking about growing up in Virginia and how he was so close to D.C. and how, and he's like, I could have been in D.C. and I could have been seeing the Bad Brains playing with Fugazi and Minor Threat, and it always bothered me because I'm like, those bands never fucking played together like that. That never happened like that.
Yeah. Well, I hope mine's not as extreme.
No, yours it wasn't. But that's why. But your answer to it is like, oh, it warms the cockles of my heart because I can just totally see going through that thought process, and that's like the sign of someone that truly loves this music.
Right, dude. It was painful. It was difficult. And if you do Wikipedia Fugazi, there is the word emo does come up.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, you're right. No, I definitely, everything you said is just, it, as I say, couldn't have been more perfect as far as an answer for that stuff goes. Wait, do you have to answer to it to Ian MacKay?
Oof, I would be afraid. I don't even know if I'd ever want to even talk to Ian MacKay. I feel like my personality is so stupid. the guy from Taking Back Sunday, Adam Lazara,
yeah,
did say something to me on Twitter like a couple years ago, because I'm making fun of a Taking Back Sunday lyric in that, like, if you slit my throat, I'd say thank you for touching me. That's like a similar lyric to Taking Back Sunday song, and he tweeted at me like, What's this song? Or what's this joke? And I was like, it's from a place of love. Because I had already been in trouble with Blink-182, because I used to do a bit years ago about Miss You, that, you know, that Blink-182 song.
Yeah.
And Mark Hoppus found out about it, but he loved it. And he was like, it was making fun of Tom DeLonge's voice. And
so he, of course, loved it.
Yeah, he was like, this is really funny, man. If I'm ever... Basically, the end of that story is that he came with my other pal, Jonah Ray, and played we played Miss You as a surprise at a show that I did in L.A., and it was like he came on stage and played the bass and sang his whole part, and it was psycho. And then we played like an impromptu Damn It cover.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, like, you know, you'd hope they have a good sense of humor, but I couldn't imagine having to do, like, comedy, especially about punk, to Ian MacKay, like Henry Rollins, like,
right,
just like the most mean mugging group of old hardcore dudes ever.
Right, dude. I mean, they truly just, I mean, come on, guys. Like, no.
They gotta laugh sometime. Maybe Danzig's there too.
Oh, geez. My buddy, his name is Buddy, has to fix Danzig's laptop every now and again, and it's like... The stories that he tells, and it's like one of, it's not a laptop, sorry, it's a old Mac, iMac, and it's like one of those like see-through ones, like the color.
Yes.
It's like that's the how old it is.
Oh my God. Well, you know, hopefully since there's reunions, they can afford to buy some new computers.
Yeah, I hope so.
That's the dream. This has been incredible and such a huge thrill for me. And anytime you want to come back, the door is always open here.
Please, dude. This is so much fun. I'm such a big fan of you, too. So I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, Whit, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Whit will be back for future episodes. I really hope. And how wild is that? That he used fucked up as entrance music for his troupe. I did not see that coming at all. And how great was my reaction hearing that for the second time, because we had to record the intro twice. So anyway, here we are. That was awesome. I really enjoyed that conversation, and I feel
very much at ease with that response to that Fugazi joke thing. That really bothered me. That was the one thing when I saw the comedy special. I'm like, oh, the Fugazi joke. And then hearing that he has also wrestled with it just made me love the guy even more. So hopefully we'll be doing a lot more stuff. That was on A24. And yeah, check it out. Really strongly recommend it. We've got time now. So if you're sitting around looking for something to watch, definitely watch that. Speaking of time, we got time enough at last to put up another podcast episode this week. And why don't we go somewhere completely different for the next one? Why don't we go to, this is good. Well, next week we're going to have someone on the show that I guess you kind of have to lay a lot of the blame for creating this genre on, or certainly popularizing this genre on. Next week on the show, one of the greatest songwriters of all time, in my opinion, because he's written some of my favorite jams, Glenn Matlock is on the show. Glenn Matlock, of course, from the Spectres, from the Rich Kids, and of course, from the Sex Pistols. And Glenn will be on the show. We talk a lot of cool stuff on the episode coming up. It's an interesting one. And certainly, you know, I've heard a lot of interviews with Glenn Matlock over the years. I've heard a lot of interviews with a lot of people from the Sex Pistols. I think there's like, you know, nothing tawdry or things like that, but, you know, the usual turn out of punk fodder, which is where we're finding about influences and connections that, you know, you don't normally talk about with people, you know? Like, when have you heard Glenn Matlock get a chance to talk about Coxbar? You know? Not very often. So tune in next week and get to hear it. All right, that's it, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. I hope everyone's doing okay under the circumstances. We're going to be launching something maybe tomorrow. Tomorrow. I'm going to be putting out some word tomorrow night about it if we do launch it. Just a test one tomorrow, and then we'll see what else comes of it. But I'm going to be, as I say, I'm going to be making sure that I keep the lights on here and keep the entertainment flowing out of here as a place for you to come and just chill for a little bit. Chill and hang out. And so we're going to be trying to figure out ways to do different things with this thing from home. Because we're all at home. Ah, that's it. Everyone, stay safe. Stay in and make your own culture. Sign your organ donor cards if you can inside. Stay inside. Stay inside if you can. Definitely stay inside if you can. And that's it. I'll see you next week on the show. Thanks for listening. Love you, everyone. Bye.